it looks like. We usually say, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals when sitting at the court, but I think we should say thank you for inviting us. It's a privilege and exciting to be here, especially among students of the law who are still bright, shining faces. It's good. I'll introduce us briefly for those who haven't. Been to our court and met our justices. To my right is Justice Sue Walker, and to my left is Justice Bob McCoy, and I'm Justice Ann Gardner, and we are your panel today. We always sit in panels of three, and there's another panel of them here today. So this is our regular Tuesday afternoon docket, and we have several cases that we will submit without argument later this afternoon in conference, but we have two to be orally argued before you today. So we'll go ahead and get started, and I'll ask Bonnie, our deputy clerk, to call the first case and the lawyers. Introduce the lawyers.
The court will now call Big Rock Investors Association versus Big Rock Petroleum Incorporated and J.A. McIntyre III. May it please the court, Mr. Kenneth Johnston will argue for the appellant. Mr. James Bradbury will argue for the appellee.
Okay, and Mike Forney, you're also trying to identify everybody. Okay, Mr. Johnston, would you like to begin? Proceed.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Kenneth Johnston on behalf of Big Rock Investor Association. As noted, Mike Forney, co-counsel here with me, and also partner Tom Capieltis. We can thank you for hearing oral argument today. This case is a question of standing and capacity. There are issues of constitutional standing that the court may entertain. It has been our view that the court, neither the trial court, which had initially granted had denied a plea of the jurisdiction, hopefully reconsidered or reversed himself, I believe, on constitutional grounds. But I don't think that a constitutional issue has to be addressed today. We'll get into that. But we are here today on a trial court grant of a plea of the jurisdiction, essentially stating that Big Rock Investor Association, or BRIA, as we have come to call in this case, has been in the trial court system since 2005. BRIA, in a parallel proceeding, an actual statutory receivership proceeding in front of Judge Lynn Wade at the time, had gotten active in a receivership. Big Rock Land and Exploration Company. Big Rock Land and Exploration Company was promoting oil and gas interests to various and sundry elderly folks throughout the country, from Florida to the state of Washington.
Investments, what were these investments? Were they actually working interests, or were they like units?
Working interest, units, joint venture interest in pipelines, all various and sundry concoctions. The record before the court shows that while it's an important question for purposes of the Texas Securities Act, from a merits perspective, it actually gets into the prudential issues that the court might want to entertain from a perspective of constitutional standing, complete fabrications, that the investments didn't exist at all. So not to get into the merits, but the basic claim is essentially a Texas Securities Act claim for failure to register security if it needed to be registered, or for material omissions because of complete fabrication. Importantly, no need to show reliance, no need to show, for example, in the federal system, the 10b-5 scienter, not a whole lot of evidence needs to be presented to establish that the violation occurred. The real fight in this case is with the appellees and whether they're actually control parties. And like I said, we've been in the system since 2005 dealing with dilatory pleas to the point where we thought we had a case. But we're here today to talk about why the Big Rock Investor Association, as the agent and attorney in fact, with an express written power of attorney for each individual investor in the the organization has capacity and standing to pursue these claims. The courts here, de novo review, the Supreme Court's Miranda case, the Second Court's McQuarrie case, tells us to look at the intent of the parties, construe the pleadings liberally in favor of the plaintiff. It's important, the intent factor, also to almost like a federal 12B motion to dismiss, if you recently, we might be seeing some of that in the state courts now, but construe the pleadings, construe the facts alleged as true for purposes of making the analysis. I don't think there's any contention in this case that Bria has power of attorney to pursue these claims. If there ever was contention, it has since been waived under Rule 93. The Nitzi case from the Supreme Court even says so, that if capacity wasn't challenged before it went into the appellate system, then it's a foregone conclusion. But I don't think capacity was ever challenged. It was always a question of, under the U.S. Supreme Court's Hunt standard and the Texas Supreme Court, Texas Association of Business standard, whether the association could have standing.
Which is a jurisdictional issue. Which is a jurisdictional issue.
It is.
And I think the main argument or the main contention under associational standing is the damages issue. And is it not true that the 239 individual plaintiffs who gave the power of attorney to Bria have individual damages claims based on a 10-year period of time and various investments and various amounts, and doesn't that require particularized proof as to each individual?
At some level, it's going to require particularized proof, absolutely.
And so how does that meet the associational standing requirement?
If to meet the associational standing requirement, we have to look, for example, to the more recent cases in the 3rd, the 5th, the 7th Circuit, where the, I would like at some point to get back to the power of attorney, but on the constitutional basis, the 3rd, 5th, and 7th Circuit have recognized the dichotomy created by the Supreme Court with regard to the three factors of Hunt. And again, the 3rd is what the court referred to. The 3rd is considered a prudential matter. It's not a constitutional matter. We actually need to step back to what Justice Cornyn said in Texas Association of Business. He did, writing for the court, said that we're going to follow Hunt. He was very clear, as appellate judges know, and particularly at the Texas Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court level, cases are very fact-specific. The holdings have to be narrow, and there's often dicta that provides some guidance to practitioners and to courts alike. And what Justice Cornyn did, said we will look to the federal system, because we're essentially adopting their rules of engagement on this constitutional associational standing test. In doing so, the 3rd, 5th, and 7th Circuits have recognized the dichotomy, and they've started to relax the prudential standard. And it's really a question for the trial court. Can the trial court manage an aggregate liability case? It's similar to a class action case. I'll tell you, we actually cited into sometimes we hate to do this, but it was the closest thing we could look at was a case that actually went to the 5th Court of Appeals in Dallas. It was Corning, Mr. Capel, and I, and some others tried roughly for about 30 investors through one investor, a receiver, and an expert witness. One investor, the receiver, and someone who actually worked with the company, the promoter of the oil and gas interest, to establish the liability and the damage in that case. So three witnesses. The jury got waived right before it got seated, and we were done, I think, in about, it was a day and a half max. So it was a limited court time. So to answer your question, it's a prudential matter for the court. Can the court manage the docket? There's evidence in the record where the receiver in this case essentially could do the same thing that was done in the other case. I have, in the Northern District of Texas, representing an entity called the Scandinavian Oil Investor Society, roughly 482 members of an association, who essentially the same power of attorney that's before this court pursued claims against a company called Omni Operating Company, and two individuals, Jeff Rustin and his brother, and his name eluding me right now, but change judgments roughly of $66 million in that case, when these types of issues had been addressed before. But you know, other law changes, cases changed, and this is a real issue, and I understand the court needs to dig into it. Just because it's worked in other instances doesn't mean it works in this instance. But in addition to the constitutional standing, the relaxed prudential standards, I think, at least from an appellate court perspective, I don't think you have to get into the constitutional standing unless you want to. Again, going back to Texas Association of Business, what Justice Cornyn said, look to the federal system, we can go to U.S. Supreme Court case 1996, United Food. It was an association who ultimately had standing based upon a statute, not our case. And in fact, neither side to this case can point to one case on point, on all fours, that says standing, no standing. We're having to look at it by analogy. So fortunately, we have good cases out there. The Supreme Court spoke in United Food Workers, and they say not to do this, but I'm going to quote very briefly. This is from the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Indeed, the entire doctrine of representational standing, of which the notion of associational standing is only one strand, it rests on the premise that in certain circumstances, particular relationships recognized either by common law tradition or by statute are sufficient to rebut the background presumption that litigants may not assert the rights of absent third parties. Again, in that instance, there was a statute, but the Supreme Court was clear to note that it could be a statute or a common law. Moving to 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court again, in the Print Communications case, a divided court, the liberal majority determined that a pure assignment for collection purposes, where there was no beneficial interest, similar to Bria's situation, where they don't own the claim, they just have a contractual obligation to pursue the claim. There was a lot of debating back and forth by the justices. The conservative dissent criticized the expansion of standing in that instance. And what they did in footnote 5 is very important, and I hope the court will read it, is they recognize, I think there was some common ground between the majority and the dissent that says we will recognize, as we did in United Food, that there are common law traditions that could be recognized. One of the relationships that was listed in this footnote is that of a trustee, where it recognized a fiduciary relationship, and the court says, look, we have a fiduciary relationship that's far different from a contractual obligation to collect. Returning to Texas, again, no case on either side that's directly on point. We can look to the 14th Court of Appeals, the Rodar case, the AFCO case, both of which recognize that and hold that a power of attorney is sufficient for purposes of capacity, provided that the member, or excuse me, provided that the person granting the power of attorney actually has standing in its own right. So a power of attorney for someone who has standing to pursue this claim is sufficient to confer the traditional standing, not the constitutional association standing.
But that was only involving one plaintiff, wasn't it?
Absolutely. But it was not a constitutional standing issue. It wasn't an associational standing. It was the type of traditional relationship identified by the U.S. Supreme Court in United Food and in Sprint Communications. So I've been asking a question for a long time, and hopefully we will get an answer to that. What in law requires Bria to establish that it should be held hostage by this associational standing doctrine? What if it were an LLC? What if it were a corporation? What if it were a trustee? What if it were an agent or a principal, like it is? There's really no difference. We're not stretching the law. It's in harmony with both Texas and federal law on non-constitutional standing to recognize the power of attorney. Count one of the original petition filed in 2005, Texas Securities Act claim, without exception, specifically says, Bria, born on behalf of its members, asserting the claims of its members. This paragraph 2 of the petition also states that they're acting under power of attorney. In the actual plea to the jurisdiction, initially filed in this case in, I believe, July 2006, the defendant, the appellee, even asked the court to take judicial notice of the claims that had been asserted in the parallel receivership proceeding, a 45-page document which painstakingly identified each individual and the claims that they were asserting. The exercise of non-constitutional standing, traditional standing, in this case via capacity, through the power of attorney, is in harmony. It will, if the court reverses and we go back and try the case, the individual members of Bria will be bound by the judgment. They are already parties to the case because their agent filed it on their behalf, just as was done in Rodar, just as was done.
Is it possible that there are investors out there who did not choose to join?
I know for a fact that there are investors that did not join. And they are excluded from the claims that are asserted by BRIA. In fact, BRIA cannot assert those claims because it does not have power of attorney to assert those claims.
The sticking point for me is that you're seeking damages. The BRIA is seeking damages on behalf of the members. And that seems to be a sticking point with the courts on that third prong of the standing test under Hunt. Can you speak to that?
We've addressed it earlier, but yes, what I would look at, you know, if the court is looking to find constitutional standing, the rescission claim, it's a claim of equity, the constructive trust, it's a forward-looking claim. I'm not going to be able to say to this court that there's not going to be any need to examine what the individual investors did. We're not going to be able to totally segregate it, but we'll be closer to a class action type aggregate relief proceeding than marching 239 investors into the court. But quite frankly, if that's what we thought we needed to do at that point in time in the case, BRIA, acting as the agent attorney in fact, could in fact bring each of those individuals in to prove up each case and each damage model.
Why is this not just a class action case?
The reason is when Judge Wade took the case, or got the case, the receivership case, there had been a tremendous amount of influx of investors calling the court. The receiver, David Jones, he and I had worked on some other cases together. He, in conjunction with the court, talked about even a similar association, and it solved the problems. And as the record reflects, it's something that Judge Wade had actually commended us on, because it took a lot of pressure off of this court. And having been through the court system on these powers of attorney before in other cases, it wasn't a leap of faith for us. The Commonwealth recognizes that powers of attorney are valid basis for one to assert claims as a nominal plaintiff with a two-party interest.
I have a procedural question. I'm not sure from the briefs, has your pleading been amended to name individually the 239 investors as plaintiffs?
It has, but the pleading was stricken we filed the question could be, what was the live pleading at the time of the initial decision versus the ultimate decision that's on appeal today? There was an intervening hearing on a motion to strike the amended petition. At that hearing, we essentially said, for purpose of this hearing, we'll withdraw the individual investors. Judge Shupp, so Judge Wade had since gone on to private practice. Judge Shupp, the presiding judge at that point in time, the record shows from his perspective that because the power of attorney is basically agent principal, that the BRIA versus the individuals is one and the same. And my understanding is it was a huge burden to actually have the clerk add 239 people to the pleading or into the computer. When we actually had this last hearing, the hearing we're on appeal today, or the ruling on the plea of jurisdiction, from our perspective, we just didn't understand the flip-flop. I think the court recognized that there was an appeal issue here, and that was going to end up in the appellate system, and that maybe it made sense to get to the second court before we spent more resources on the trial court.
But that plea, so the pleading where we stand now has been struck?
The amended pleading that listed all of the individuals, actually listed the individuals and BRIA, that pleading is not before the court. It was struck simply by agreement.
It was not struck due to limitations?
No. At the September 30th, 2001 hearing transcript, court record volume 3, lines 17, line 21 through 18, line 11.
Did you mean 2011 hearing?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson speaking. Kenneth Johnson again on behalf of plaintiffs. Your Honor, for purposes of today's hearing, the plaintiffs would agree to remove the individual members from the petition. We ask the court for 7 days relief to amend basically to take the individual members out as named plaintiffs. Caveat, we would also, and I don't know if we reserve need to reserve that right, but we'd like to look at the books to see if it makes sense at some point in the future to seek formal substitution. In court, I think that's a good plan. Mr. Johnston, I think Mr. Bradbury would like some type of formal relief from the court, but we think that we can cure the issues through that protocol. That was followed up a few days later with an actual order striking the plea. So from a merits perspective, relation back, misnomer, and those types of issues had not been addressed.
Thank you.
With that, we would conclude. We ask the court to reverse, issue a mandate directing the trial court to recognize Bria standing as agent and attorney is back with full capacity and standing to pursue the claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnston. And we'll hear from the appellee, James Render. Please.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. The central question before the court is a pure question of law. Does an association suit for legal damages on behalf of its members arising out of investments confer subject matter jurisdiction over a Texas trial court? And the answer is absolutely not. The cases of Texas Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, are in accord. When an association seeks damages on behalf of its members, there is no subject matter jurisdiction and there is no standing. This is clearly an association. The petition was filed as an association, and that is the only party before the court today. Although the brief takes some license in suggesting and using the plural for appellants, there is only one appellant, and that is the association that sought damages. Because they sought damages, there's a very precise test and legal parameters that apply to the question for the court, which is whether Judge Chubb acted properly in dismissing this on subject matter jurisdiction. The appellees believe that he did. If I can leapfrog back to the question you were just talking about, then I'll come back to the standing on this strike issue, because I think it is interesting, although it's not before the court on this appeal. This was not struck by the court. On the eve of the first hearing on the plea to the jurisdiction, Bria had been the only plaintiff. And we were heading into the hearing, and days before that hearing, having maintained that the individuals need not be parties to the case under the third prong of the Hunt test, the appellants spontaneously threw in all 239 individuals into the case right on the eve of the hearing. So this is how Judge Chubb found this sudden change, and I'll say it caught him by surprise. So what the court did is it said, and we filed a motion to strike and maintained our plea to the jurisdiction, because of course, if there was never any subject matter jurisdiction over this case, you can't throw 239 members at the last minute into a case that never had subject matter jurisdiction. So we separated these two procedural questions. On the motion to strike, Judge Chuck did strike that amended petition and those individuals from the case because, as Justice McCoy pointed out, it's long after the statute of limitations.
But is that the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, and I don't know that it forms a basis for a motion to strike.
It is irrelevant. The statute of limitations and the strike, all of that is irrelevant for today because Justice McCoy asked it and it was a discussion. I wanted to clarify that was not by agreement. There's not an issue of statute of limitations in this case or in the court's review. It is irrelevant. The question here is whether there was subject matter jurisdiction over this case that was filed in 2005 by Green.
Well, it does sort of come into play towards the end of whatever our decision is, because if we were to hold that the grant of the motion to dismiss the one jurisdiction was proper, we would still have to consider whether the plaintiffs would be given an opportunity to amend. The Supreme Court has told us to do that. But it sounds like they did amend.
They did amend. It became one of the points of discussion before Judge Chuck was, can you amend in parties into a case that was never properly constituted? And so that's why I believe that's why he separated those two questions, is you had to determine whether there was ever subject matter jurisdiction and a lawsuit under Texas law to begin with before you got into these issues. As the court knows, the Supreme Court of Texas in 1993 adopted the Supreme Court's Hunt test and the three-pronged test to apply to associational standing. And that has never varied. Those three prongs have never varied. The appellants have attempted to sort of blur the lines on the third prong and say that there's prudential concerns where a court can just sort of enter into a gestalt analysis. That is not the case at all. That decision has remained so. This court has already issued one opinion in the Texas Municipal League versus Burns, citing that law, relying on that law, and citing the aspect, which is really the legal issue before the court. If you seek damages on behalf of your members, there cannot be standing.
What about the claims for breach of fiduciary duty and the constructive trust?
They are still seeking money damages because the reason for the rule of no money damages is because that makes it quite obvious under the third prong that the participation of the individuals is going to be required. So in this case, with 239 investors, 10 years, multiple investment days for each investor from a variety of entities that allegedly sold these interests, even for a constructive trust claim, there's no way to get there without having that testimony of those individuals and knowing what those transactions were.
Well, it looks like the constructive trust claim pleads prospectively for recovery of monies that are still in the possession of the defendants.
They are seeking money. And once you seek money under Texas Association of Business in Texas, Worth versus Settling at the United States Supreme Court, that throws you into the category. You can't do it as an association on behalf of your members.
I'm not sure I can agree with you that if you seek any monies, I think that it has to be monies common to all of the individual plaintiffs that are being represented by the association. But I don't think any claim for money automatically defeats associational standing if the monies are common to the entire pool of plaintiffs. And so to the extent that a constructive trust is sought to recover not monies uniquely attributable to one of the 200 plus individual plaintiffs, but to recover monies generated by these investments that are still in the possession of the defendants, I'm not sure that violates the third prong of the associational standing test.
Aside from the money, that once you seek money, you're into our argument, once you seek money, you are out of standing. The third prong is still the primary question, which is whether the individuals have to be a necessary part. And I see no way, even in a constructive trust theory, as Justice Walker is putting forward, that could be carried out, that could be tried, and adequate proof could be put before the court to necessitate a judgment of that matter. Without the participation of these individuals. Because each of them would have to prove, I bought these securities then, and there were these statements that I relied upon, and here's the basis for my relief. That is the disconnect between pursuing a case like this as an association and pursuing it with the individuals. And although Worth versus Settling, which I believe is the case that's most squarely on point, this was an association of builders that challenged an ordinance in the city of Rochester. But the association sought damages on behalf of its builders. They said, if you enter this ordinance, which we believe is unconstitutional or improper, we're going to be damaged. And the Supreme Court made particular note of the fact that that association had no standing because it sought money damages. And Texas Association of Businesses picked this up. And even the case United Food, that counsel for appellant cited some language from, makes very clear these and later precedents have been understood to preclude associational standing when an organization seeks damages on behalf of its members. Yeah. Possibly, if the association itself had some damages, the cases don't really vary, but that's a different situation. But here, where it's an entire pass-through, everything they collect, even though they're constructive trust theory, is going to go to these members, you have put yourself into a procedural context that no court has endorsed, in Texas or the United States.
Well, this case, it seems a little different from a case where a whole bunch of investors had individual misrepresentations made to them, for example. Different actions, different statements that might have caused them to invest and be defrauded. It seems like, at least based on the pleadings, that everybody's lost, and I'm not to the amount of damages yet, everybody's lost, all the members lost everything they invested because of one big fraud, or one big action that affected everyone the same, and it's just a question of the amount of damages.
I don't believe that's correct, Justice Walker. What may not have come to the surface in the briefs in this case is the transactions that are issued over these 239 investors took place over a 10-plus year period of time, and each investor engaged in transactions over a period of years with different entities. There are different entities which are not my clients. This case is about pursuing someone who has control. The ultimate, the culpable person here was prosecuted and ultimately killed himself before they took him off to prison. But aside from all that, the investor claims that are at issue here all took even one investor. That takes place over a series of transactions with different entities. Each would necessitate proof of, here's what they told me then, this one was false, that transaction was false. And so it becomes impossible when you amalgamate 239 individuals over 10 years in all these entities.
So the Ponzi scheme is what it's been called.
Absolutely.
So some people might, like someone that invested over a period of 10 years, obviously, that they got some money back to keep the thing going.
That's, although it's not really in the record here, that's absolutely, and I think it's agreed here that the perpetrator of this was taking in money from Oklahoma, Indiana, and circling it around and paying it back to some and not others. The FBI characterized this as one of the most elaborately carried out schemes that they had ever analyzed. So all these monies are moving a whole variety of ways in and out. Some investors came out to be net winners, and some were net losers. All pointing back to the fact that you cannot, under applicable law, pursue as an association for these types of claims. Even assuming they weren't seeking some sort of money damages, but more equitable type damages, because you have to call them all into court. You can't just.
Go ahead. No. I was interrupting you.
That's quite all right.
Well, you said equitable, and I thought rescission. What about rescission?
Well, this was argued before Judge Shuck too, and rescission sort of opens that side of your head where you think, well, that's equitable, that's different, but. A rescission claim in this case means each investor gets their money back. So they're getting their money back in just a rescission form of award rather than a true, you know, compensable damage. But in order to get there, to justify Investor 1, Investor 5, and Investor 100, they're going to have to tell their story individually. So that's going to violate the third prong of the Hunt test, which leads us back to this absence of subject matter jurisdiction. Each of these individuals has to plead to prove their own damages. The appellants have maintained that somehow the Hunt test has been softened by Texas Supreme Court or later U.S. Supreme Court cases. It just hasn't. It has not on this particular prong. The appellants, I believe one member of the panel pointed out, the cases cited by the appellants, if you will look at them closely, they involve an individual with a power of attorney for another individual or a corporation with a full and complete assignment for another corporation. That's different. Once you are an association, you are absolutely under the Hunt test, and you must satisfy the Hunt test. The appellants have failed to justify reversing the trial court's ruling. There was no subject matter jurisdiction on this because they saw the damages.
Thank you, Mr. Bradbury. Rebuttal?
Yes, may it please the court. Clarification, the United Food case was an association case. It did violate the Hunt factors of the third prong, if you would, but the U.S. Supreme Court identified that there's other basis that associational standing was not the exclusive basis, and the court identified two things, the traditional relationships and a statute, and it happened to be a statute that applied in that case. So there is, by analogy, cases before us that shows that the associational standing doctrine, which is a very narrow strand, should not hold Rhea hostage to other means to an end. And here, the power of attorney and agent attorney in fact, the principal and agent relationship, the fiduciary relationship that the Supreme Court identified in that footnote 5 in its dissent. How can we just disregard that? The Hunt doesn't tell us, Texas Association of Business doesn't tell us to disregard other forms. If anything, those cases say, well, look to other cases to see what those cases say. United Food tells us what we need to do. Sprint tells us what we need to look at. Rodart, AFCO, Texas law recognizing the powers of attorney. How many transactions throughout the state of Texas are done on a daily basis on a power of attorney? To disregard a power of attorney just because there's some argument that an association should be held hostage, it has unintended consequences that just should come to bear. Returning to the constitutional issues, and particularly the damages, there's before the court an affidavit of the receiver, David Jones. Paragraph 9 of that affidavit says, I could and would testify regarding the financial losses sustained by the individual claimants in this case with reasonable certainty, with minimal participation by the individual claimants. He knows that he can do that, and the reason is because the rescission claim. Each member of the Big Rock Investor Association, what we would call a net loser. These are people that didn't get fully repaid from the recirculation of money through the Ponzi scheme. Regarding the motion to strike, the real issue that was never litigated in the trial court, which I think the court alluded to, that it might have to address this issue, is could there be a substitution of parties? Frankly, I don't think amendment is the appropriate way, because essentially, you have a nominal party before the court right now. That's what the power of attorney does. It's a capacity issue. The question is standing. If that association doesn't have standing, then is substitution appropriate? It's our view that it would be. There's no surprise to the athlete. They've always known, and in fact asked the court in July of 2006 to take judicial notice of all the claims and all the members that have been filed in the associated receivership proceeding. The constructive trust. The panel noted the difference of constructive trust. If the court is aware of what constructive trust is, it doesn't mean that RIA and its members get to have all this money that they might recover. There's a receivership proceeding that is still pending before Judge Chubb. It also is in abatement. But the receivership is not over. Yes, this case has been going on for a long time. There have been a lot of dilatory pleas that these individuals have been dealing with. It's their hope that the court will reverse, give them their day in court, let them pursue whatever claims are available to them to get some of it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in this case, and I want to thank you for excellent briefs and arguments. Appreciate your coming over from Dallas, and Mr. Bradbury for your case is submitted, and you are excused. Thank you.